Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Am I coming home? Hello and blue, Eastern blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I.
Welcome to another fantastic episode of Your World News. I'm your host Solomon, joining you from the belly of the beast. And today we're gonna continue the second part of the four-part documentary entitled "The Ravaging of Africa." I felt it was apropos for me to play each one of the four parts of this documentary, given the fact that we're going to have one of the documentary's creators, Asid Ismi, on the show within the next couple of weeks. And you guys definitely stay posted for information in terms of when he's going to be on the program. And you can always do that by going to blogtalkradio.com/YOUR-WORLD-NEWS. So that's Blog Talk Radio, Your World News. And so without further ado, before we actually start the second part of the documentary, this one is called Economic War, and basically it's going to outline the many nefarious ways that economic warfare has been waged upon Mama Africa, and leading us into the show was none other than the late, great Garnet Silk, and that song was entitled Mama Africa, and that's growing to become in our very fledgling existence of Your World News, that's coming to become the theme of our program in terms of the tone and tenor and the passion that Garnet Silk was espousing throughout that song. And so definitely with this show, as well as last night's show, you know, there was a strong focus on the continent of Africa. And those of us who are Western-born Africans, it's vastly important for us to continue to connect the dots to show the relevance, the great relevance that the continent of Africa has upon us. I mean, first and foremost, that is the birthplace of our existence. All right, we as people of African descent, that is without Mama Africa, without Africa in general, that's the birthplace of humanity. So it's vastly important for us to take a lot of stock and pay a lot of attention to what's going on the ground in Africa, and not just through the lens of the corporate mainstream media. And that's what Your World News sets out to do. We set out to cover news from around the world from a vastly different perspective and context than that of the mainstream corporate-backed Western media. We also feature commentary and interviews. This is what we had last night with Brother Kambali from Friends of the Congo. We've had Keith Harmon Snow on, Abiyomi Ezekwe we've had on, and you know, so many more that we will continue to have on this program. But that's an example of some of the commentary and interviews that we have that you'll never hear of on the corporate finance mainstream media. They're afraid of that because, you know, if they aired news in its proper context, most of the time, you know, there would be a finger point to them in terms of complicity, as well as their corporate parents' responsibility for a lot of the ills that we see, not just within the empire of the United States of America, but also throughout the world. Look at the ills of capitalism, runaway capitalism, and how it's reared its ugly head throughout the world, the ills of imperialism, the ills of colonialism. So obviously we can't rely on the MSNBC and an NBC to portray the ills of these extended campaigns of war in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq. Of course they're not. You know, their parent company, GE, creates weapons of destruction, weapons of mass destruction. You know, a weapon of mass destruction is a bomb, a missile. It's not intended to just take out one individual. It's intended to take out entire compounds and whoever is in their path is going to be destroyed as well. And so, Of course, they're not going to talk about the military-industrial complex and how it's fueled, because they're a part of the military-industrial complex. And the sooner we really understand, you know, these issues and their complexity, how corporate America, mainstream media in America is in bed with the political structure in America, regardless of whether you're trying to look at the Democratic or Republican Party, the sooner we will understand that this conspiracy is not a theory, it's something that's alive and well, that they create laws and mandates and things of that nature to make it easier for all of them. You know, so the one scratches one back, and the other one will turn around and scratch the other's back. And that's how it's done. And with little to no thought of the people, the mass of the people are in this case, countries that are being devastated by their uh, their the role that they play, you know, devastated by their actions, their motives, their moves. And so we do have the power to change that, but without understanding the issues and their complexity, it's hard to, it's going to be that much harder, I should say, for us to continue to move forward and to wage a strong, organized fight against these structures. So this is what Your World News does, you know, no bones about it. You know, our perspective is going to be from the perspective of the downtrodden, the proletariat, the indigent, you know, people who are stepped upon, those who are marginalized and oppressed. That is the perspective that we're going to show. That is the news that we're going to show. And so we're not going to show the news of the invader. We're going to show the news of the many, many, you know what I'm saying, people that, you know, that have been destroyed, you know, since the Obama administration has stepped in and carried out the same killing spree that the Bush administration was carrying out throughout their the majority of their administration. So we're gonna talk about the people in Afghanistan that are being destroyed, the innocent civilians that are being destroyed by way of these manless drone airstrikes, as well as the air raids that are manned, you know. And so they're taking out large chunks of civilian population. So we're going to talk about those things, and we're going to continue to talk about those things. We're going to talk about solutions, as we did last night with the conversation we had with Kambali. We talked about solutions. He outlined a whole slew of things that people can do, you know, within their own households, within their own communities, within their own schools, organizations, to make a difference in the lives of the over 60 million Congolese people who are definitely having an economic, having a physical, psychological war waged upon them by Western multinational corporations, Western countries, as well as some corrupt individuals within the continent of Africa. And so we definitely got to continue to do everything we can to learn these issues. And so if you want to listen to that episode as well as this episode or any episode that we've had, they're all in archives just by going to the website. You can listen to those websites. I mean, you can listen to the interviews or the broadcasts of any one of the shows that we've done just by going to the website. But I want to actually go over a couple of headlines. I think that in terms of news, since we're talking about news that is alternative to what the mainstream covers or doesn't cover, I should say. And, you know, I have a couple of headlines courtesy from Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report. And if this is the first time you've ever heard of Black Agenda Report, please visit that site on a daily and on a weekly basis. Just go to www.blackagendareport.com. That's one of the very progressive, hard-hitting analytical news sources. And they're an online news source, but they also do radio commentaries that are freely downloadable and with the intent that you can pass along to your friends, your family, because knowledge is power. The access to information is power. That often leads towards some type of varying level of activism, as I've said so many different times, and as many other people have said many, many times. And so without further ado, this is an interesting story that Glenn Ford just covered on Black Agenda Report today. They come out every Wednesday. But you can visit this website, you know, all throughout the week if you can't get there on Wednesday for some reason. But this whole wave of charter schools that is sweeping the nation, the whole, you know, wave of you know, this whole fanfare about charter schools that the Obama administration is pushing through the person that he appointed, and I don't know how or why, you know, this person was appointed, but Mr. Duncan, Arne Duncan, you know, this guy used to be the CEO and that's a title that used to be called superintendent. And so it's very, very interesting that the superintendent of a lot of public school systems in America have now been switched over to CEO. And if you read the writing on the wall, I mean, they're being run like businesses. They're being run like businesses. And so this individual, while he was in Chicago, serving as the head of the Chicago public school system, he turned over various schools that, you know, that had a large population, of predominantly large population of blacks and Latinos, turned over those schools to the military, and they turned into public military academies, you know, if you will. And as you know, that's oftentimes a feeder system into the military. And if one enlists in the military now, you have an over 80% chance of being sent to somewhere in Afghanistan or Iraq. And that's a fact that's not talked about a lot. You know, you enlist today, you have a greater than 80% chance to be sent over to Iraq and Afghanistan. But this individual, Arne Duncan, has never, and I guess I say Arne, some people say Arnie, or, you know, but Arne Duncan, he has never spent a minute in the classroom as a teacher or anything like that, and basically was running a failing public school system, a school system that he was privatizing, and that's the whole way, is that these charter schools, yes, most of which are publicly funded, but when you look in the case of New Orleans, there are publicly funded but privately run. So that when you hear that word privately run, that means that those private organizations that are running them are getting their dough as well. You know, so instead of putting the money into the public school system and revamping public school systems and giving them and the teachers the money and the resources that they need to have a fighting chance to succeed, the same kind of resources that, quite frankly, their counterparts are getting in suburbia. And you know, folks, and I'm not the first person to mention this. I mean, you know, look at the work of Jonathan Kozol. If you read, you know, Savage Inequities or Savage Inequalities or read Shame of the Nation, he talks about this. He talks about how there are schools in the Bronx where, the average student was getting about $11,000 for the year, and these are public schools. But then, you know, less than 10 minutes outside the Bronx into suburbia New York State, in public schools that had, they were predominantly white students, they were getting like $21,000, $22,000 per student. And yes, we know that some of that has to do with the fact that property taxes have a lot to do with how much various school system or schools are going to get. And that's one of the huge injustices that occurs in this country. That's one of the huge, I mean, that's ridiculous that, you know, based on circumstance, if there's a neighborhood, inner city neighborhood, and most people are obviously living in apartments or Section 8 housing or what have you, they don't care any less about their kids getting a quality education than does, you know, their white counterparts, you know, an hour, a half hour, in this case, 10 minutes outside of the city. But they don't have property. So they get penalized, and the folks that are in suburbia, because they own property, because they're homeowners, that means that, you know, they're going to get more money for their school systems. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous, and it's an injustice. It's an absolute injustice. And so we see that, you know, this whole change that you can believe in or hope, it's been a facade since day one. And so I just want to play this, and I'll see you on the other side. It's about a 3-minute commentary and reporting of news by Glenn Ford.
A new study out of Stanford University is shattering the myth of charter school superiority. According to Stanford's Center for Research on Education Outcomes, students at only 17% of charter schools do better on math and reading tests than their demographic peers in regular public schools. 37% do worse, while 46% of charter school kids, almost half of them, perform at approximately the same level as their traditional public school counterparts. The author of the report concludes, "This study shows that we've got a 2-to-1 margin of bad charters to good charters." The results are especially significant, given that charter schools have built-in advantages, starting with parents that are engaged enough in their children's education to put them there in the first place. Yet the actual outcomes, in most cases, fail to live up to the hype. President Obama and his administration are ideologically committed to charter schools. Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who was cheerleader for charters when he ran the Chicago school system, is threatening to withhold federal education money from the 10 states that don't yet have charter schools and from the 26 other states that put limits on enrollment in charters. Such raw coercion is unconscionable, especially given the results of the Stanford study. Duncan responded to the study by urging charter school forces to pay more attention to quality. But he continues to demand that 5,000 schools be shut down, their teachers fired, and 250,000 new teachers hired. The Obama administration position is based on ideology, not empirical data, and would lead to a forced proliferation of charter schools in districts eager to hold on to federal dollars. If the Stanford study is any guide, half the new charters will be no better than the traditional schools, and most of the rest will be worse. Unionized teachers are blamed for the ills, all of them, of urban education. It's not a reasoned argument, but a matter of faith and political prejudice. Charter schools are not private, but they are the privatizer's foot in the door, a wedge issue to demonize unions in the black community, even in those cities where many, if not most, public school teachers are black. In Chicago, as Bruce Dixon reported in last week's issue of Black Agenda Report, the proportion of black teachers has dropped from 39% to 31% since 2002 because of school closings. In New Orleans, most of the school system has been replaced with charter schools, along with a disproportionate share of black teachers, to the cheers of the Obama administration. It's the same story all across the country. Obama's people used the same language as the Bush regime did in attacking public education. Charter schools, they say, are key to educational reform and provide competition for traditional schools. But that's utter nonsense if the educational outcomes are no better, and in many cases worse, than in the regular public schools. What we are then left with as the only remaining rationale for charter schools is to break the unions and move closer to privatization of public education. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So you see, Brother Glenn Ford laid it out lucidly in terms of understanding some of the intricacies of what's going on right now, what's starting to come down the pipeway. And if you're in a community that is governmentally neglected, I try to stay away from that term ghetto or slum, because I think that, you know, it kind of takes attention away from the real culprit that created these environments called ghettos or slums, and that's the government. I mean, these things didn't just, you know, just didn't come about as soon as black folks moved into them, you know, post Civil War era, Emancipation Proclamation and so forth, when blacks started to migrate up north. And they were prepared for them. I mean, this is exactly stacking people on top of one another, starving them of economic resources, and then watching what happens, you know, escalated crime rates, you know, riots. We saw with the Kerner Commission in 1967, you know, LBJ, you know, commissioned Otto Kerner to study the effects, like to find out why, you know, there were so many riots and civil unrest within black communities. And they found out, you know, what many of us have known for a long time without having some some white man tell us, you know, through some, you know, empirical study. But the report came back that, and distinctly said that, you know, basically racial discrimination, the media played a large part in terms of the so-called black-white schism, but that's basically code for, you know, stereotypical discrimination of blacks and their portrayal on the media, you know, the hyper-dramatization, those types of things, as well as lack of economic resources. You know, with a lack of economic resources, you have all these different things that become fertile ground, and you know, these school systems that don't have half of the economic resources that their suburban counterparts have. It's absolutely ludicrous, and it's an extreme injustice. And so wherever you are, especially if you're an economically disadvantaged community or a governmentally elected community, whether it's Detroit City or Compton or wherever, Chicago, Illinois, make sure that, you know, it's very important to support the teachers and teachers' unions. I mean, you see with the push for these privately run charter schools, you know, they're trying to eliminate the teachers' union. And the teachers' union has to exist, because without the teachers' union, you're going to have teachers that are going to be forced out of their profession based on the fact that for a number of reasons, you know, salary included. I mean, we all know teachers don't get, you know, especially quality teachers don't get paid half of what they deserve. You know, unions are those apparatuses that push for a stronger work environment, a better work environment for those that they serve and those of the teachers. So, you know, I thought that was important to highlight, you know, so by playing Glenn Ford's piece, I hope that that's, you know, what it did. And some of you listening may know far more about it than I'm covering. But if so, please, you know, pass that information along to as many people as you can. We have to continue to raise the specter of consciousness in our communities, one person, one community, one family, you know, one city at a time. You know, so anyways, the last piece I want to play before we actually start the radio documentary, The Ravaging of Africa, Part 2, Economic War, is this piece that has to do with blacks and transportation.
It's often been said that there would be no first black U.S. president were it not for the civil rights movement, and that's obviously true on its face. But what happens when the first black president fails to enforce civil rights laws already on the books? The National Black Chamber of Commerce, with encouragement from the heads of a conference of black mayors and the National Black Caucus of Black State Legislators, charges Barack Obama's Federal Highway Administration isn't enforcing key portions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. As a result, black contractors in states across the country have increasingly been shut out of federal highway construction work. Harry C. Alford, the National Black Chamber of Commerce president, dates the problem to the tail end of the Clinton administration. Since then, he says, many thousands of black firms and millions of black citizens have been denied an equal opportunity for contracts and employment in the transportation sector. The flaunting of civil rights laws has been allowed to fester so long, said Alford. You can take a drive on Interstate 80, starting in San Francisco, and drive all the way to New Jersey, and there's a good chance you will not see one black working on a freeway construction project. The black contractors and elected officials now fear that African Americans will be cut out of the huge one-time increase in federal highway money under the economic stimulus program passed this year. Their letter to administration officials was quite blunt, referring to money that is coming down through racist channels and demanding to see change from the administration and to see it now. The Black Chamber of Commerce would be well advised not to hold its breath. President Obama's well-known modus operandi is to run from racial issues like the plague. He treats civil rights as a done deal, an accomplished fact for which we should all be grateful and then collectively move on. Obama hammered the point home yet again in early May when he told a press conference that he had no plans to directly address historically high black unemployment. The president whipped out the old discredited cliché that a rising tide lifts all boats and promised that his stimulus program would create that rising tide. But, as the Chamber of Commerce president wrote in his letter, the stimulus money will be directed through those same racist channels that have been denying blacks contracts and jobs. Unless the president puts on the pressure, there's no reason to expect any change at the Federal Highway Administration that black folks can believe in. Remember also that Obama insisted he wanted to pump additional money into state and federal programs that were shovel-ready, meaning projects that were already in the pipeline and could be put into motion quickly. By definition, this meant the usual suspects would get the contracts and the jobs. If blacks were shut out before the Obama administration, they would be shut out of the stimulus. It's as simple as that. Far from ushering in a new era, Obama's philosophy of governance reinforces the racial status quo, which, for black people at a time of economic crisis, means falling further behind. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And if you are a strong Obama supporter, it is definitely your responsibility to push him and to pressure him to make the changes that you expected, that you feel that you were promised when he was running. You know, I didn't vote for him, and I did not vote for John McCain. I actually voted for Cynthia McKinney. That was the only candidate that was the viable choice, the obvious choice for me. She covered all the major issues that I wanted to see in terms of real tangible change. And before that, she had a strong history when she was in the Democratic Party. She ran as a within the Green Party, but when she was in the Democratic Party, she had a strong history of fighting the, you know, the system, tooth and nail. You know, she challenged, you know, folks within the Bush, you know, the Bush regime, when most of her colleagues in the Democratic Party, you know, acquiesced, like, you know what I'm saying, collapsed like a house of cards. They were worthless. And so Obama definitely is not going to get pressure within his cabinet. His cabinet is very much a part of the problem. When you look at, you know, folks like, you know, Bob Rubin and Larry Summers, yes, the Larry Summers. We could spend an entire show talking about that nefarious character, but Rahm Emanuel. You know, these are folks that are part of his, Susan Rice. These are people that I can go on and on that are part of his cabinet that are not going to pressure him to do, to invoke the kind of change that we want to see in our communities. And so, you know, if this is the first time you've heard somebody, you know, especially somebody black, you know, challenging Obama, that someone black that's not a conservative, that's not a Republican, and you feel like you're about to implode, you know, brace yourself. You know, there's many of us out there that are progressive black folks, people of African descent, that did not support his run for presidency. And if you think that, you know, we worked against the system because, you know, we could have almost ushered in John McCain, that's the limited range in which the system wants you to operate. They want you to believe that if you don't vote for the Democrat, you know, who's running, then it's a vote, you know, then and you're voting for some, you know, independent, what have you. You know, the only other choice is to, you know, to sit there and allow the Republicans to get into power. That's absolutely absurd. You know, why should I vote for the lesser of two evils or the evil of two lessers? You know what I'm saying? Why should I limit myself there? Voting, you know, our ancestors of African Americans, of people of African descent, they died not for us to waste our friggin' vote on a candidate that we didn't believe in. They, you know, many of them shed blood and tears and anguish so that we would have the ability to vote, but I think the ability to actually think about and examine the candidates tooth and nail before we went into those voting booths and pulled the trigger, I guess, with the dive old machines, you push the button, to make a choice that sits well with our consciousness after we've done the critical examination, the critical thinking. And it was just, it's just kind of like eerie to see the cultish mentality of so many Obama supporters. You know, some people call them Obamites or Obamanistas or what have you. You can't say anything. You can't say anything critical about this guy. And even when you say critical things about this guy and it's stuff that they've never heard before, they still want to continue to challenge you instead of saying, oh, I didn't know that. You know, let me go research that. If that is true, that's really going to change the way I think about him, you know. And I need to really, you know, make sure that I write him a letter, write his the White House letter and do what I can to pressure him. Nah, they do the exact opposite. Like, hey, I'm just gonna challenge you, challenge the messenger, even though this is the first time I'm hearing this information. But you know, you must be lying. You're just anti this. You're not black enough, which is like a joke. And then you tell them that you voted for a black woman, and then oh shoot, I got to come up with some other excuse why you didn't vote for him. So it's our job, everybody, to make sure that we pressure our elected officials and we organize, and to create a better system where there's more than just two candidates that are dominating the center stage every 4 years. You know, the fact that Cynthia McKinney was the Green Party's nominee and she wasn't even invited because the corporate media would not allow her, because they're often the ones that make the decisions in terms of who's gonna be on the debate platform or not. As I said before, they're in collusion with the DNC and the RNC. And so it's all already set up that the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee are going to be forced out. And what that is, that limits our range. That limits individuals' range to even know about a Cynthia McKinney. Because I bet if most people knew, especially most people from governmentally neglected communities, knew about the platform before they even knew about the candidate, and they looked at all different platforms without looking at the cult of personality, you know, that was Obama or McCain or what have you. If they just looked at the platform without knowing who the candidate was, I'm trying to tell you, I pretty much almost guarantee the vast majority of those people from those governmentally neglected communities, the so-called ghettos, I guarantee you the vast majority of them would jive with and go the route of the Green Party's platform and Cynthia McKinney's platform. Guaranteed, because her platform addresses their needs in a concrete, tangible, pragmatic manner that these other corporate friggin' parties don't. And so as long as we have this two-party system, it limits your range, and it's not democratic. It's not a democracy. It's not a representative democracy. It's the exact opposite. It's not a representative democracy. They're throwing at you their two favorite candidates. And so they're omitting all of these different, you know, third party and fourth party candidates, you know, and independents that have worked tooth and nail to campaign throughout the country and earn their party's nomination. And what are they awarded with? They're awarded with the door being shut in their face before they even get to the placemat, before they even get to the doormat. I mean, it's absolute absurdity, and it's not a democracy. It is not a democracy. You look up the word democracy, and you know what democracy means in its essence. That is absolutely the opposite of democracy. So anyways, that's sorry for me to run off on my tangent. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about those things more in depth in the future, where we have some shows where the lines will be open up for callers. But I want to get back with the program and play this documentary. This is the second part of the ravaging of Africa, and it's apropos. It was a good segue because I did mention food and rice. So indirectly, it was kind of a jagged segue towards this because Susan Rice used to be, she worked for the Clinton administration, and she was within the State Department. Her responsibility was to oversee various African affairs, and she's a war hawk. I mean, if she had up to her druthers, she would bomb the hell out of Somalia. She would bomb the hell out of any African nation that did not cater to U.S. Western imperialistic visions and grandeur, whether it's AFRICOM or she's one of the biggest supporters of AFRICOM, Africa Command. Definitely look that up if you haven't heard about that. And, you know, now she's the United States representative within the United Nations. And, of course, you know, she's a talking mouthpiece, and she thinks she's brilliant, and you know, not saying that she's not in some degree, but she's very disingenuous. She's nefarious. I'm not a big fan of hers in any shape, form, or fashion. Her idea for a free, independent Africa is the total opposite of what the people on the ground in Africa need. She is an imperialist, and so that's a nice segue. And so I want to play this 20, it's about a 25-minute documentary. This is the second part of Ravaging Africa. It's called Economic Warfare. I hope you enjoy it. I'll see you on the other side to briefly close out the show and to wish you guys all a good night. Here we go with Economic War within the Ravaging of Africa, done by Asad Ismi and produced by Christian Swartz. I am Solomon, coming from the belly of the beast. You know what that is.
The ravaging of Africa has been enriching Europe and North America for more than 500 years.
First, European empires imposed slavery and colonialism on the continent.
After 1945, the United States took over as the dominant neo-colonial power.
Through the Pentagon and the CIA, the U.S. government has fueled 14 wars in Africa with arms transfers and military training.
This is American invasion. Well, the U.S. role is everything.
The U.S. has used the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to systematically demolish African economies and health and education sectors.
Par les stratégies de la Banque mondiale, les pauvres seront toujours pauvres, les riches seront toujours riches.
This military and economic war enables the looting of Africa's resources by Western multinational corporations.
Shell is into the politics of Nigeria, you know. We might say we have our independence, but economically, we are still being colonized.
Washington's genocidal imperial strategy has killed more than 26 million Africans, but failed to suppress popular resistance.
We have refused to die. We are living for Africa. No matter what they do, no matter what power they have.
You are listening to The Ravaging of Africa, a four-part documentary series about the destructive impact of U.S. imperialism on the continent. I'm Asad Ismi.
I'm Kristen Schwartz.
Voices and sounds in this series were recorded at the 2007 World Social Forum, held in Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Economic War, the second episode in our series. For the next half hour, we highlight the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. This episode features voices from Guinea, Zambia, Kenya, and South Africa. Stay tuned.
Washington has fomented not only military conflict in Africa, but also an economic war through its agents, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, known as the Overlords of Africa. The structural adjustment programs imposed by these institutions on 36 African countries since 1980 have devastated the continent, decimating national economies and health and education systems. Structural adjustment programs offer loans on condition that governments drastically reduce public spending, especially on health, education, and food subsidies, in favor of repayment of debt owed to Western banks. Governments must also increase exports of raw materials to the West, encourage foreign investment, and privatize state enterprises. The last two steps mean selling whatever national assets a poor country may have to Western multinational corporations.
Under structural adjustment programs, sub-Saharan Africa's external debt has actually increased more than five times since 1980. This is despite the fact that African countries have paid back four times their 1980 debt to Western banks. In 1997, the United Nations Development Program stated that in the absence of debt payments, severely indebted African countries could have saved the lives of 21 million people and given 90 million girls and women access to basic education by the year 2000. The All-African Conference of Churches has called the debt, quote, a new form of slavery as vicious as the slave trade, unquote.
After more than two decades of structural adjustment programs, 350 million Africans live in absolute poverty out of 682 million. The number of poor people has increased by 75% since 1994. Life expectancy has dropped by 15% since 1980, and today is 47 years, the lowest in the world. 40% of Africans suffer from malnutrition, and more than half are without safe drinking water. Healthcare spending in the 42 poorest African countries fell by 50% during the 1980s. As a result, healthcare systems have collapsed across the continent, creating near-catastrophic conditions. More than 200 million Africans have no access to health services, as hundreds of clinics, hospitals, and medical facilities have been closed. This has left diseases to rage unchecked, leading most alarmingly to an AIDS pandemic. More than 17 million Africans have died of HIV/AIDS, which has created 12 million orphans. 28 million Africans currently have HIV.
About 40% of African children are out of school, and the adult literacy rate in sub-Saharan Africa is 60%, well below the average in developing countries of 73%. More than 140 million young Africans are illiterate. Given the annihilating social impact of structural adjustment programs all over Africa, it's not surprising that Emily Sakazwe, director of the Zambian anti-poverty group Women for Change, has asked, "What would the World Bank and the IMF say if we took them to the World Court in The Hague and accused them of genocide?"
In Guinea, World Bank and IMF structural adjustment programs have left half of the people in poverty and 45% of them unemployed. Yet Guinea, like the Congo, is very rich in natural resources containing half the world's bauxite reserves used to make aluminum, the third largest gold and diamond deposits in Africa, and 4 billion tons of iron ore. Bauxite exports provide 80% of Guinea's foreign exchange, and the state aluminum company has been privatized, with 51% of it being owned by Alcoa, the U.S. multinational, and Alcan, the Canadian corporation. Most revenue from Guinea's main income earner thus leaves the country.
Under pressure from Washington and the International Monetary Fund, the country's U.S.-backed military dictator, Lazana Conte, cut social spending and price subsidies in 2006. This led to mass demonstrations against Conte, culminating in a general strike led by labor unions, which paralyzed Guinea in January 2007. Conte reacted by declaring martial law and unleashing the army, which killed 100 demonstrators. The general strike ended on February 27th after Conte agreed to appoint a new prime minister acceptable to the unions. Since then, the army itself has revolted against Conte, with soldiers looting towns and terrorizing civilians because they say the government hasn't paid their salaries and owes them $93 million.
Bakary Fofana is director of the International Trade Center for Development in Guinea.
Les politiques d'ajustement structurel, les exigences de la Banque mondiale actuellement ont fini par détruire le seul instrument qui est à la disposition des citoyens, instrument collectif qui est l'État. L'État aujourd'hui est détruit.
The rules set by the IMF are destroying the state in African countries, which is the one common thing that the people have and own.
Justement. Et si l'État est détruit, c'est la justice économique, c'est le développement équilibré au niveau national qui sont totalement détruits.
The government is destroyed, the state is destroyed, and this represents a social and economic injustice.
Privatization enforced by the World Bank in Guinea has created its massive unemployment and impoverishment.
In most African countries, including my own today, there are no more national industries left. They've been taken over by privatization. It is privatization that comes in a situation where there is no local economy. There is no local financial structure in place for a local capitalism to grow and thus create a local industry. So there is no economic development. The fact that there is no local industry and there is no local economy anymore, the effect of this is that there is no income from the resources in a country that is going towards government. There is nothing for the government to take from the workforce and from the resources in the country. So the situation is very bad.
De 1960 à 1983, on avait plus de 200 entreprises nationales.
In Guinea, between 1960 and 1983, there were more than 200 national enterprises. These were enterprises set up by the state. These companies produced everything from shoes to medicines to juice, all consumer products that were used daily. In 1983, the government changed hands and the new government decided to adopt a new form of politics. The World Bank came as consultant and they pushed for the privatization of the 200 enterprises. Today, none of these enterprises, none of these factories are functioning. What is sad is that the price for which they sold these was very, very low. What the World Bank suggested was that the government had to get out of the manufacturing sector and leave that in private hands. These enterprises were selling not only within the country, but also selling to neighboring countries. They were functioning well.
Ces entreprises aussi ont disparu. Aucune de ces entreprises n'est opérationnelle aujourd'hui.
The World Bank's demand that Guinea cut social spending has caused the collapse of the health and educational systems.
Le taux de couverture sanitaire aujourd'hui est extrêmement bas. Puisque la Banque mondiale et le système économique qui a été mis en place empêchent effectivement à la fois à l'État de pouvoir subventionner.
The level of the health system is extremely low. The level of care is very low because the World Bank is preventing the government from funding the infrastructure and funding the rebuilding of the sanitation and health systems.
Aujourd'hui, quand on n'a pas de moyens de santé, vous trouvez des hôpitaux où il n'y a pas de simple mercurochrome pour soigner les gens. Et vous trouvez à l'intérieur des médecins, parce que les médecins sont mal payés, on fait payer à des malades, justement, ceux qui ne peuvent pas payer, alors que c'est l'assistance publique qui devrait le faire.
When people show up at the hospital, there is such a lack of funding that there is simple no medicine. Doctors, because they are being paid very, very poorly, are asking people to pay them. People who don't have anything to pay with. These costs are supposed to be covered by social benefits provided by the government.
Sur le plan éducatif aussi, on en parle moins, c'est qu'aujourd'hui, nous assistons effectivement dans ce domaine aussi, c'est qu'il y a un manque d'emploi. Puisqu'il n'y a pas d'emploi, les jeunes sont désemparés, les écoles ne répondent plus à la demande justement de la société. C'est un déphasage, c'est parce que tout simplement, tout a été détruit par ce système économique incarné et mis en œuvre pas justement par la Banque mondiale.
The education system is also failing because there are no jobs afterwards, so young people have given up. Ultimately, there is nothing left. The social structure, economic structure and educational structure are falling apart. They are failing completely and the societies are being slowly destroyed because of this lack of funding and infrastructure in the countries, which is caused by the system and policies put in place by the World Bank.
World Bank and IMF policies have had especially harsh effects on African women. Sarah Longwe is from Zambia. She represents the regional organization African Women's Development and Communications Network.
Women are not represented at places where decisions are being made in terms of the resources, you know, how the resources are used. And also they are not part and parcel of how the political parties run themselves, because there are very few women in the political parties position. And because of not having a voice at a national level as well as at a political level, we find that the policies, economic and otherwise, have been having adverse effects on women. For instance, When the government started borrowing money from IMF and they accumulated debt, there was no decision made collectively, which included women, to say what we should borrow the money for and how we should use it. And when the debt accumulated, women have been the ones mopping up because of these subsidies have been removed from education, from health, from roads, and these are the very areas which affect women. So women actually have been the ones who have done the subsidies for the economy.
Trade liberalization, extensive privatization, and cuts to health and education spending forced on Zambia by the World Bank have killed tens of thousands of people and made the economy collapse. Zambia holds 10% of the world's copper, which is the country's main income earner. The privatization of copper mines and other enterprises has caused such massive unemployment that only 500,000 Zambians are formally employed out of a population of 11 million. This incredible unemployment has forced women and children into prostitution, which has fueled the AIDS pandemic and created yet more hardship for women. Zambia's life expectancy today is 33 years, the lowest of any country in the world.
People who used to think that they had enough income, they don't have income anymore, and they are totally demoralized, and they've been depression, especially among the men, because to find that they are totally dependent on their wives, and then the wife, what she's doing to keep everybody together is inhuman, to the extent that she has to go early in the morning to the outskirts to buy vegetables and get back, and in between she has to pay the go-betweeners, which would include having sex for the services, or actually the family taking the kids to go in the streets and have sex so they can bring money.
With the kids? Sex with the kids?
The kids have to go out also to get an income. So kids have become stealing, or they become sexually abused if they can be given money, and also that has other effects of drugs. You know, because they're doing things which are really bad and to themselves. So there's a lot of glue sniffing. It's very different from the West, because you use drugs which you can, cocaine and things. Although there are some who do that, but people have created other form of drugs to forget hunger, to forget the inhuman things they are doing. So they sniff glue. They make the, if I would call it glue, because initially they were sniffing glue, but now they've found a way of creating this, you know, different petroleum, different chemicals. You know, they mix, it could be paraffin, and then it gets into a strong mixture, and they sniff that, and it for a while it takes all the misery away.
The devastating HIV/AIDS pandemic in Zambia has been declared a national emergency by the government. 17% of Zambians are HIV positive, and there are over 700,000 children who are AIDS orphans.
Some also traditional cons have come into play and have even come with even worse things, you know, like for instance, you can be cured for AIDS if you sleep with a virgin, if you sleep with somebody who is 70 years old. So nowadays there are gang rapes of little kids, gang rapes of old women.
World Bank mandated trade liberalization has destroyed the agricultural sector also, thereby causing the expansion of urban slums as well as encouraging the spread of HIV/AIDS. By allowing cheap crop and food imports into African countries, trade liberalization has displaced local farmers who cannot compete. Many such men are forced to move to urban slums for work, where they get infected with HIV due to unprotected sex, and then spread the disease to their wives in their home village. In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, about 60% of the population lives in slums.
Caroline Adeyambo is a resident of Madare, one of Nairobi's oldest slums, where she works as a volunteer with the Madare Mothers Development Center. Caroline is a home-based caregiver who takes care of HIV/AIDS patients.
You know, we as volunteers, we are the ones overburdened with work. The health caregivers are doing nothing at all, because they wait for their salary at the end of the month. Whether there is a sick person there, they don't care. It is upon us, we caregivers, to go and take care of the sick person in the hospital as well as back at home. I give care to the bedridden patients who are living positively, or without AIDS or with AIDS. As volunteers, we take them to the hospitals. We look for the relatives if they're near. We dedicate the work to the relatives so that we don't get overburdened. But you know, it comes to a time when we have to go back to our pockets, because when you go to visit a patient, sometimes you find there's nothing, completely nothing in the house. So you have to go back to your pocket, produce some little cash to help the patient. In the other hand, you are not employed. You also, at your side, you have a need. So it becomes difficult there. And otherwise, we are happy because we are happy to see our fellow friends improve and they are back to life again.
Kenya has only one national referral hospital, the Kenyatta National Hospital, in a country of over 31 million people. The combined effect of the AIDS epidemic and tuberculosis on Kenya has been catastrophic, given the destruction of the health system by World Bank-sanctioned cutbacks. More than half of Kenya's hospital beds are occupied by patients with HIV/AIDS-related infections, and life expectancy in the country has been reduced to 48 years.
Kenya was the first country in Africa to come under a World Bank Structural Adjustment Program in 1980. After 27 years of adjustment, more than half of the population lives in poverty, and Kenya is 148 out of 177 countries on the United Nations Development Program's Human Development Index, which measures a nation's development in terms of life expectancy, education, and standard of living. Most Kenyans consume less food calories today than they did 30 years ago. Under World Bank IMF pressure, the Kenyan government has recently privatized Kenya Railways, resulting in the layoff of 4,000 workers.
Njoki Getetwa is coordinator of Kenya Debt Relief Network.
IMF and World Bank in this country, with their structural adjustment program, has completely destroyed the social fabric of this country. What is important is that is the insistence that workers must be sacked. You increase employment in a country that is trying to generate employment. You increase frustrations in a country which is trying to hold together the social fabric. You increase social turmoil in a country that is supposed to be stable. Because once you destroy, you sack somebody from jobs, what you're doing in effect is to tell that country to go to hell and suffer. You're causing social breakdown.
The World Bank is insisting on even privatizing as essential a resource as Kenya's water, in spite of the disastrous consequences of this policy all over the world. These include sharp price increases, greater unemployment, corruption, and severe declines in accessibility, service, and quality. Already, only 14% of Kenyan households have piped in water.
Through privatization, the World Bank has encouraged massive corruption in Africa and the rest of the South. As author Sue Hawley explains in her report on corruption written for the British NGO Corner House, the growth of corruption across the globe is largely the result of rapid privatization of public enterprises, along with the reforms to downsize and undervalue civil services pushed on developing countries by the World Bank, the IMF, and Western governments supporting their transnational corporations. Hawley estimates that Western corporations pay $80 billion in bribes a year.
Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist at the World Bank, called privatization briberization. He spoke about how some politicians gladly sold their electricity and water companies. You could see their eyes widen, he said, at the possibility of commissions for shaving a few billion off the sale price.
Kenya's U.S.-backed ruling class is well known for its astounding corruption, especially in the era of President Daniel Arap Moi, who ruled for 24 years. Moi set up a kleptocracy and assassinated and tortured his opponents. Under him, the Kenyan elite and Western multinationals monopolized Kenya's wealth, making it one of the most unequal nations in the world. The richest 10% of the population control almost half of Kenyan wealth, while the poorest 10% have only 1%. Under the direction of the World Bank, privatization became another mechanism of corruption to increase the wealth of the elite and Western companies.
Moi Kibaki, the current president, has been beset by two major corruption scandals that have forced the resignation of three of his ministers. Beginning in 1992, on the insistence of Western governments and the World Bank, the Kenyan government put up 207 companies for sale in one of the biggest privatizations in Africa. Many companies have been sold far below their market value, resulting in enormous losses to the state. Not only has the World Bank encouraged corruption in Kenya, it has directly participated in it. In May 2002, the bank's officer in charge of Kenya's roads program pleaded guilty to bribery.
For example, a company like a telecommunication industry is privatized. Once a company like Kenya Airways is privatized, once anything is privatized, it is always a player, it's always an interplay of strategic forces and interest to take control of that given industry. We have seen industries in this country which were privatized when the business class and some people in the business class are very well prepared. We are talking about a situation where they are privatized when multinationals are very, very much aware. So the people who come exactly take these industries, it's not even the people, it's strategic players in the corporate world. And this corporate world, they part with a lot of money to support operatives within the government. It means that there was a lot of resources and interests that were exchanged basically to tilt the balance and to generate corruption and bad governance.
Since most African countries are largely agricultural, the distribution of land is the most important economic issue on the continent. In South Africa, 13 years after the end of formal apartheid, a tiny white elite still owns most of the land, while millions of black farmers are landless. 87% of South Africa's land is owned by white, Dutch, and British colonizers, as well as by foreigners living outside the country. Many of these are multinational corporations such as Anglo-American, De Beers, and Monsanto. Whites make up 12% of South Africa's population.
The World Bank is setting South Africa's land policy and has told the African National Congress government not to expropriate land or it will be economically punished. The bank insists that the decision to sell land should be up to the owners and the government should pay the high prices that they demand. Mainly because of the denial of land, 61% of black South Africans live in poverty, and close to 40% of all South Africans are unemployed. Archbishop Desmond Tutu has warned, quote, we are sitting on a powder keg, unquote.
Molefe Pilane is an organizer for the Landless People's Movement in South Africa.
We created this organization after we realized that the issue of land in South Africa has been ignored even by the new rulers of South Africa who won independence in 1994 from the colonizers, the Dutch colonizers. They were then advised by the World Bank and the IMF to say that they should not take the land which was taken from the indigenous people in the past. They should not take it away from the colonizers, but instead they should use money, the state coffers, to actually buy the land from the colonizers or the settlers. So some of the settlers have been pushing the prices of the land deliberately high, knowing that they will make profit out of that. So the process has actually stopped, because the government does not have enough resources to buy the land. But also, if they try to amend the law to say that they're gonna maybe expropriate some of the land, the value of the rand, which is our currency, collapses because of the international, you know, connections of the IMF and the World Bank and the multinationals. So that's the situation that we find ourselves, that the multinationals, the US, through its agencies of the IMF and the World Bank, is forcing African countries to actually buy land which was taken by the settlers from the settlers with high prices.
The South African Landless People's Movement's tactics focus on education.
So that's a very difficult situation that we find ourselves in. But the resistance has been there. We've been organizing people around the issue of land and educating people about how land is important so that it can help them to grow food, to take them out of poverty. People are starting to understand that they have to stand up on their own and confront this U.S. imperialism that has been, you know, pushed down their throat through their agencies of IMF and the World Bank and other international monetary agencies.
You have been listening to Economic War, the second episode of the documentary series, The Ravaging of Africa.
The Ravaging of Africa is dedicated to the memory of Patrice Lumumba.
This series was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. Go to www.asadismi.ws, that's www.asadismi.ws, for more information or to download the series.
Translation by Maziar Mahajir at Toronto Conversation Corner and Farid Omar. Voiceover by Benedicta Madawo.
Theme music is Ner Balankina by Captain Yaba from Ghana.
The series was funded by Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 3903, QP National, Canadian Union of Postal Workers National, GovW North Bay Local, Canadian Labour Congress, Public Service Alliance of Canada, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and Mining Watch Canada.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for listening. That is going to conclude our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed the second part of The Ravaging of Africa. That was entitled Economic War, and we'll be airing the last two parts probably later this weekend and early next week. So just stay abreast with the website. Just check the website periodically. And remember, if you can't catch something live, I know we all have busy lives and we can't always be online to listen to the show live. But if you cannot listen to the show live, you can always catch the show on archive. All the shows are immediately archived. Probably I'd say they're archived within 10 minutes of the show ceasing. And so you can listen and you can pass the link on to your friends, your networks, and family, and colleagues. Like I said, information is power. That is just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to be getting to all these different topics when we actually have Asad Ismi, the creator of that radio documentary, on the program probably within the next 2 weeks. And just trying to work out a time and date that is convenient for his busy schedule. So once we do that, we'll have him on the show to talk about a range of things. But, you know, this is the first time you're hearing these things. Yeah, there's, you know, people within the continent of Africa are under a lot of distress and under various different forms of warfare, and that it's vastly important that we engage ourselves in these issues. The same way we allow the media to engage ourselves in issues in other parts of the world that are important to the imperialists and the corporate. You know, the corporate head that run these multinational corporations, you know, they create the issues. If you notice, you pay a keen eye to the television, the dumb tube, and you know, you don't want to watch too much of it, but if you watch the news just a little bit, you'll see that they frame the news the way they want to, and they air the news that they want to. And so if an issue, if something's going on in Congo, and, you know, we've seen the worst loss of human life since World War II that is going on in Congo, and you don't hear anything on, you know, about it on the nightly news. You definitely don't hear about it every night on the nightly news the same way. We've heard about different conflicts in different parts of the world. You look at the 90s, and you look at what was going on in former Yugoslavia with Slobodan Milosevic and, you know, the Balkanizing of Yugoslavia and how Clinton sent in, you know, troops in the support of NATO you know, we heard much more of what was going on there as compared to what's going on in Congo. And in Congo, we know that over 5 million people have perished since the 90s. If this was Yugoslavia, if this was some other European nation, you best believe it would be in the hearts and minds of pretty much every American, because it would be front and center on the news every single night. It's not a coincidence that this is an African nation that is being ritualistically and purposely ignored by the corporate, criminal-minded mainstream media. And so, as I said, we can't allow them, we cannot allow the mainstream media or, you know, people that run Western countries to dictate to us what are the important priorities, what is important in terms of world affairs. We have to make it incumbent upon ourselves to seek alternative outlets for news. You know, look at even looking at news outside the U.S. is vastly better than looking at, you know, this crappy news that we see within the U.S. It's okay to look at, you know, the Washington Post and New York Times from the standpoint that you're comparing and contrasting, yeah. But if that's the primary, if your primary news source is the Washington Post, New York Times, MSNBC, CNN, ABC, Fox, White Supremacist News, you know, if it's any of those outlets that you're getting your primary source of news, you probably do not know what's going on in the world very much. You know, those things should just be things that you contrast to other forms of news to really highlight, like, ah, you know, yes, you know, they are full of crap. You know, they are, you know, purposefully mincing the news and mincing words to fit their own agenda. So Africa and what's going on in the continent of Africa has to be front and center. We have to be vigilant in terms of how we critically examine events and issues within the continent of Africa, as well as other places as well. We need to look at what's going on. I mean, look at what was going on in Peru a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, Alan Garcia, president of Peru, slaughtered, you know, through his army, slaughtered, you know, dozens of people of indigenous Indians from Peru that were protesting the selling off of tons and tons and tons and tons of acres of land, you know, within the Amazon, you know. And it's just amazing, because he was selling that land off to folks like ConocoPhillips, other multinational corporations that are ready and chomping the bit, ready to get into Amazon and start cutting down the land and turn it into what they want to turn it into. So we gotta, like I said, we gotta vigilantly fight and you know, with our minds, with our organization skills. So, anyways, that's it for tonight. And I will let us. I guess I'll go with old faithful, and that's Uno the Prophet, an MC, a rapper out of the state of Massachusetts, specifically Boston, Massachusetts. This is the rap, the hip-hop music that you will not hear on the mainstream airwaves of Clear Channel or Viacom, you know, which is BET, MTV, VH1. You won't hear it anywhere there until we change the system. And so, but you will hear it on alternative media radio stations that are, you know, throughout the U.S. that most people don't know about. But hey, you could change that. You can make sure people know what a Black Agenda Report is, even though that's a news site, you know, literature based. But let them know about my site and so many other folks that are doing some strong things on independent radio. Take care, and see you on the next episode of Your World News. Forward ever, backward never.
This song probably been done about a million times,
Uno
but it ain't
problem.
Never been done like
half
mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans. We're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about a million of our people in prison. We're talking about a million of our people dead, unemployed, homeless, hungry, B. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans. 100 million Africans.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
They say we ain't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Hold it down.
Think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of they pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wildin'. Y'all shuckin' diving.
Yeah, it's about
grinning and smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names. That Turner Devil Burner come to burn your shit to flame.
We gon' burn it
1
down,
million
baby.
Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans,
1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back.
Cracker, tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box, I will crack a jack. After that ain't nothing else to do but to holler black.
1 million kids who ain't got no options. Either they down with the goons or the goblins.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is a Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a
black man?
Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man. Finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power. Had 6 million people taking gasoline showers.
Nine.
The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that don't mean to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Y'all niggas got it backwards. Y'all niggas got it backwards.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
1 million Wampanoag, 1 million Black Sheep, 1 million Navajo, 1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about 1 billion people, maybe even 2. We take a nation of millions on us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though.
Breaking more.
I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees, know the score. Cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at your door, man. I am Farrakhan and 1 million man marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often, 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
Harriet Tubman came too. We got a long legacy, this is how we do it. Uno the Prophet, Nat Turner, Devil Burner. 1 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust. Don't forget. A million,